You're listening
to the When Life Hands You Lennons podcast.
But in an entry-level film production, it's one strike and you're out. You're fired. I'm not calling you back.
If your goal today is to make a basket, we're going to make that basket.
The minute you create something, as soon as it's made tangible, you have a copyright in it.
How do I get our guys to sound that big, you know, that full when they do the harmonies?
And I'm your host, Lennon Seahawk. Let's get to the show. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of When Life Hands You Lennons. Happy New Year, everybody. Let's hope 2021 is a lot better than 2020, because we know 2020 was an absolute disaster. But things are looking up for this year. Hopefully things get better, and I'm sending everybody good energy through the podcast that 2021 will be a better year. So this week's episode is with Alexander Seaver, who leads Mako. Now, I'm going to read a little bio about them, and then we'll kind of get into what the show is about. So Mako is the creation of Los Angeles-based producer, singer, songwriter, composer Alex Seaver. Originally founded in 2011 as an electronic duo alongside former member Logan Light, Mako today operates as a one-person act that spans the worlds of alternative pop, indie rock, and electronic music, with Seaver leading the way as the sole producer, songwriter, frontman, and creative force behind the project. And in this episode, we talk about his newest project, which is his album Fable, and he describes it as his most truest sound yet. And we get into a whole other hodgepodge of things like composing, the projects that he's working on, how to become a composer, how to differentiate the Mako project from the clients that he's taking on as a composer. We talk about how you can make a living doing music full time and a whole bunch of other things. So before we get into the conversation with Alex of Mako, I want to remind you to please sign up to my mailing list, as it helps me notify you when new episodes like this are live. I would also appreciate a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, because it greatly helps the show get boosted, or follow it on any other platform that you listen to podcasts on. You can check out my website at lennonseahawk.com. You can also sign up to the mailing list there as well and check out podcasts, blog posts, everything else that I'm kind of up to in the projects that I'm working on. There is a guest request form in the show notes below, so if you or somebody you know would be a good guest for the show, please fill that out. Lastly, give me a follow on Instagram. Trying to get my followers up and boost content and creativity on there and network with all of you people. So please follow me on Instagram, send me a DM, let me know what your favorite episode is, let me know who you want to see on the show. I do have some big guests planned for the show this year, so stay tuned for that. So without further ado and my continued rambling, let's get on to my conversation with the incredibly talented Alex Seaver of Mako. Thanks for joining me. I know it's kind of a busy time of year for everybody, but maybe this year's a little bit different. So tell me about who you are. Give the guests a little bit of a background about who you are, and then how you've been working through kind of this crazy quarantine.
Sure, yeah. So my name's Alex. People might know me as Mako, is my artist project. I am an electronic producer slash songwriter and film composer. And yeah, COVID has been so rough for so many people, and I'm incredibly grateful to say I just happened to be one of the lucky ones where my work was just me alone in a dark room the whole time. So the kind of quarantine situation didn't affect me, and studio time. I was a studio rat all along. I don't tour a whole lot, so I just purely by luck dodged a bunch of bullets there, and I've been able to keep busy, finish up my record, and you know, get things going despite everything going on.
Cool. And you do primarily electronic music. So what are some of the songs you've done? What are some of the crazy stuff that you've accomplished in the electronic scene?
Yeah, you know, I definitely started as a purebred kind of EDM producer and a duo, actually, with my old partner, Logan. And I would have described all of that music that first couple of years as progressive house, is what we were calling it at the time. You know, think Swedish House Mafia and Avicii and Alesso.
Sure.
And I was lucky enough to work with a bunch of those guys. I got to write on Avicii's first album, and I worked with Steve Angelo and, you know, a whole host of other DJs. And that kind of propelled me into the second part of my career, which was more as a like pop singer-songwriter. So transitioning my project from a DJ electronic project to now sort of this like indie rock pop electronic kind of outfit.
So when you're finding your sound, I imagine it's a lot different when you're transitioning from like progressive house to like this indie. Like, what's kind of that process like in discovering your sound? And like, I'm assuming it's kind of an ongoing process.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and I have to be honest with you, I really only feel like with this new album, Fable, have I, quote-unquote, like, found a sound. And
wow.
I've been hacking away at this thing since, you know, 2012 or so, so we're looking at, like, 8 years of, you know, just learning by experimenting and by modeling things after all the artists that I admire. And I think there comes a time in a lot of people's little careers where they just go, okay, I need to take a leap of faith now. For me, I got sick of just kind of sounding like so many other people, and I just wanted to invent something. So I really took a chance with this record to say, you know, what is my sound? And the result I came up with is, let's grab everything in your background, from your French horn degree to your film scoring interests and your pop writing and your DJ and EDM pursuits. Like, let's just sandwich that all together and make something out of it. Excuse me.
So what... I mean, I'm assuming all of that stuff took time, but what else? Why 8 years? Like, why not, you know, finish it in two and, you know, put it out? Like, what is it that's super special about this?
Well, I didn't know to do it. I mean, you know, everybody hits this stuff at a different pace, but it's like growing up almost. It's like when you're a fully formed adult as you hit your late 20s, it's like, why didn't you act like this when you're 16? Well, it's like, well, I needed to be an idiot and make a ton of mistakes and try a bunch of things before I could arrive at this place. It's sort of like a deeper personal wisdom that you can really only get by just paying attention and living your life and trying to challenge yourself. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is that it gets somewhat comfortable to just sink into a status quo or to an expected kind of model, or swim upstream like everybody else is. I mean, the comfortable thing about electronic music specifically is that everybody creates this mold that is very comfortable to just be like, okay, I'll do it like these 27 other DJs, and nobody's going to question me for it because we're all doing this. I mean, this is part of the genre. It's like we're contributing to this thing, which is dance music, and it's beautiful for all those reasons. But I just personally felt like I don't feel that proud of what I'm doing, and I want to feel proud of what I'm doing. So there's risk involved in that kind of thing. And it just takes a leap of faith, really.
Sure. And have you always been a musician? Do you come from a musical background? Your family,
yeah.
Parents?
Not so much from my family. I mean, my parents like very, very loosely played an instrument or two, but it wasn't like in my household growing up. But for some weird reason, I started playing in, you know, middle school band and just like took off. Like, I just loved music in a way that I didn't expect. And for no understanding of my own, like, somebody gave me a French horn in middle school, and I ended up being like, yeah, I want to be a professional French horn player, which is the weirdest thing to say. And so I went to Juilliard as a French horn major, you know, thinking I'd end up in orchestras and stuff like that. And, you know, talk about like a weird turn of events to get me to where I am now. I mean, I'm not playing French horn anymore. So that's one indication that, you know, my life took a couple turns.
Wow. And did you graduate from Juilliard?
Yeah, I finished my undergrad there.
Wow, good for you. That's quite an accomplishment. I can imagine Juilliard's pretty intense.
Yeah, that's a great word for it. It was kind of like the movie Whiplash, except without the physical abuse part. It was just mental abuse and just total anxiety. And, you know, like, we're in, like anybody, you're in your early 20s, so you're having like these identity crises of like, who am
sure.
I? And then we would wrap that into like, my entire identity is the instrument I play. Like, I don't have anything of value other than that. And so when you graduate from a school like that and you don't pursue that field, you kind of feel like you're coming out of prison. Like, you have no skills to enter the workforce. You just like, I don't have anything. I'm starting from scratch here. And so I landed in LA after graduating with literally zero skill. I mean, I had some like things going on in my brain that I learned from school, like ear training and music theory and stuff like this, but you can't like apply that to a gig. You got to figure out how to use those tools and do something entirely different.
Mm-hmm. So what's a day in the life as a student there?
Yeah, it's a good question. So no liberal arts classes except for one. So it's literally day, you know, the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, you're just eating, sleeping, and breathing music. They split it up into a bunch of different kinds of courses. So we had a music history course, music theory. We had ear training. You have a lot of different ensembles and stuff. So, like, you have to play in a chamber music group, which is like a small ensemble. Then you have to play in the big orchestra, which is the school orchestra. And then you take private lessons with a teacher. And that's kind of like your entire education is based around studying privately with somebody on faculty there. So a lot of times you'll get these situations where students are going to a school not because they like the school, but because specifically their instrument teacher is so great that they want to study with that person.
Interesting. So what was that transition like after you graduated from Juilliard? How did you get from, it's New York, right? They're in New York.
Yep.
New York to Los Angeles, and tell us about that transition into electronic music.
Yeah, it was a dark period of my life. I'm not going to lie. Like, my senior year, my teacher was basically like, hey, listen, you're not going to make it. And I was totally crushed. And so I just made this pilgrimage out to LA because I thought, well, shit, like, I love movie music and movie music happens out there. So might as well just wander out there. I'm from San Diego originally, so it was kind of close to home. And I just, by stroke of luck, met a guy named Logan who, you know, our dads were college roommates, and I met him during the summer, and he's like, do you want to come to Electric Daisy Carnival? And I was like, I don't know what that is. Like, sure. And I really hadn't heard anything musically outside of classical music for most of my life. Like, I was just a purebred nerd. Like, I did not know what was going on in the world. And this is as EDM's just exploding. And so he takes me, and like, my first contact with electronic music is seeing like Swedish House Mafia at EDC. It's like, does it get more like absurdly overwhelming than that as like your first dose? And I was hooked. And so I was like, you know, let's mess around. I think one of the things, like, sort of like the ego of it all was like, I heard the music and I was like, oh, I can tell what's going on, like, harmonically. I could, you know, take it apart musically. And so I thought, oh, that sounds easy to make. I could make that. And I, you know, was so naive to realize, like, no, it's not. I mean, it took me years to figure out how to make it. And even then, I'm never that happy with what I do compared to those guys. So, what it did is it just gave me it like, basically Indiana Jones swapped out my dreams for another idea very quickly before my whole life could collapse. And I could just, like, be so depressed where it was like, oh, no, my life's falling apart. Boom, here's some electronic music. And that just kind of kept me distracted almost while I was healing from my wounds. And then what do you know, I started falling in love with it. And then that just led towards everything else that I've been doing.
Electronic music is such an interesting genre. Like, it's so broad, but it's like, when you see these pictures and videos and you go to these festivals like Coachella, EDC, like, these people are just there to have a good time and just totally let loose. And that's such a beautiful thing. Like, we can all just get along and just put aside whatever's happening in the world and just get along and have a good time and enjoy the music. And that's such a beautiful thing to be able to do that. So you were super inspired and you got into that stuff. What was it like starting producing electronic music? Like, what program did you start in? How did you learn this? You obviously had a music theory background, but learning a DAW is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, I kind of describe it as it is literally learning another instrument. I find that the learning curve is about the same amount of time. Like, you can't pick up a guitar and expect to impress people with your guitar playing for, what, 3 to 4 years, you know, minimum. And I found that it was a very similar arc with Logic is what I use with these DAWs, where the frustrating part was, unlike learning an instrument for the first time where you're not aware of how trash you sound, I just finished up Juilliard. So the entire process of learning electronic music, all I'm doing is able to hear how garbage I am and just like, oh, all I hear is imperfection. And I can describe to you why it sounds awful and I can't get it there. So it was a lot of trial by fire. And, you know, everybody learns so differently. And especially with the resources today, like, kids are hitting, you know, YouTube tutorials like gangbusters. And there's now during COVID, you know, like, I'm watching Disclosure stream their productions and stuff. Yeah. And it's amazing.
It's great.
And for whatever reason, like, I didn't learn that way, or it wasn't around for some reason. So I just learned by doing, basically. I mean, I just used my ear. My ear was sort of the master tool that I had from school, which is like, I can hear harmony and melody and texture and all those things to a really, like, evolved degree just because I spent my whole life dedicated to that. So let me just listen to a Swedish House Mafia mix and just pick out every individual instrument and just, like, start to figure out, okay, if I do this with the kick, if I sidechain this thing, it'll start to sound like this. And I just kind of learned like that.
So how do you, I mean, like a technique like side chaining, how do you learn to do that by ear? Like that's obviously some routing that takes place.
Yeah, the side chaining specifically is a bad example of something I taught myself. It was like definitely something you encounter when you're just trolling the internet or when you start to like collab with people. You'll see somebody do pop open a plugin and you're like, what the hell is that? And you just kind of learn like that. But it's not so, I mean, there's only so many tools that we use, but it's like, you know, I'm hearing everybody talk about compressors and I'm not entirely sure what compression is or how it works or when to use it tastefully or the difference of quality between two different compressor plugins. And like, you just can't really crash course that stuff. You got to like spend time in it. And I would describe that there's a lot of parallels. I mean, we'd have to listen to an entire orchestra and pick out what the cello is doing and decide if it's clashing with what the viola is doing. And similar, you have to train your ears to like hear a sound and immediately have a sense of what frequency spectrum it's resonating the most at, because like that's your orchestra is like this EQ band. And so I had never thought of music as frequencies before. So it was like a very parallel, but like completely new way of interacting with sound. And, you know, production's a very math-based adventure. And classical music isn't so much. So it definitely like took some time to kind of get used to using my brain that way.
So when you're in producing and stuff like that, are you kind of mixing as you're going along? Like, do you mix your own stuff? Do you master your own stuff? Like, what's kind of like, walk us through your production process and then into going into mixing.
Absolutely. So the quick answer is I have Miles Walker mix and get my music mastered. But when I deliver my music to him, I get it as far as I possibly can, as if I were to release it myself. Mm. So I'm still used to the behavior of mixing a thing. But just to give my mixer some props, he's incredible. He'll actually touch up the final stuff. But I am a big advocator of knowing the order of events that you want to embark on a piece of music. And it's different for other people than it is for me, because I'm singing, writing the song, and producing the track. So I find that songwriting and production, they deserve to be separated. Like, that's why most collaborations happen between a songwriter and a producer, because it gets really sticky really fast if you're triaging a piece of music. Because what we do is problem solving. That's really what it is. To be able to hear something that's not quite working and decide, is it because the melody in the vocal is not good? Is it because my vocal performance isn't good? Is it because the production's too busy? Is it because of blah, 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 the arrangement? Like, there just becomes such a like wide factorial amount of things that could be causing you harm. So what I try to do, and I switch gears. Like, sometimes I'll just write a song at the piano first, and then my whole world is figuring out how to add production into that. And sometimes I just start making a beat, and then my world is like finding a song that will just sort of flow with it. It's a little bit of back and forth, but I would say almost all my productions will like heavily be a song first or heavily be a track first.
Mm. And are you writing lyrics, chords? Like, what do you kind of typically say? I mean, obviously it probably varies, but what do you tend to lean towards?
Yeah, I mean, chords are like everything for me, because I write melodic music. So like that is the fabric of the emotion. So like I'm not even committing to an idea until I know what I want the color of the emotion to be. And then in terms of lyrics, it really depends on the gig. Like, I do a lot of writing for League of Legends. I've been lucky enough to write their last four Worlds anthems that they put on each year. And those are, I kind of think of it as like commercial writing, where I'm not writing for myself. I'm writing for a client. So in that case, the lyrics are really important to nail down before I really embark on the song. Like, you know, they came at me this year and said, hey, we've got this campaign going called Takeover that we're doing. We need you to write another anthem. And I just thought, Takeover, that's great. We're taking over. So like the song doesn't really begin until I know what the central message is, the big fat chorus. But not all my music is like that. You know, sometimes the story of the song kind of tells itself to me as I'm writing it. I mean, there's some things I just sort of plunge into with nonsense lyrics. And then as I live my life a little bit, I go, oh, that moment I had kind of sucked. Let me actually put that into this song. So it's not a great answer, because I'm basically telling you like it varies. But, you know, it really does vary based on what I'm doing at that point.
Sure, sure. So tell me about writing for a client. Like, do you do a lot of composing for clients? Do you like what? Tell us about that world. Like, how do you differentiate your own personal project to like composing for League of Legends?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm doing a lot. So I'm scoring a TV show right now, which is the first time I've ever had like a big film scoring project. And I'll be able to announce that like in a couple months, hopefully. But we've been working hard on that, and then writing songs for them, and then writing songs for other artists is, I consider, like a commercial thing as well. And, you know, it's a skill set, and you have to, it's a challenging one, and I actually really love the challenge of it, but you're writing in service of something else is the summary of it. Like, this isn't music for you to love, it's music for your client to love. And when you are getting pretty good at it, you're able to understand what they love and make something that you love within that boundary that they've created. But it takes a while to get there. And so when it's a world's anthem, I need to picture this music will be performed on a stadium in front of 100 million people streaming live on Twitch. It needs to sound like that. It needs to feel like that. And I find it really great because now that's created a boundary for me where I know the song has to hit these peaks before I deliver it or before I even show it to them. Sometimes Mako music can be really challenging because it's like, it could be anything. You know, what if you want it to be anything, what the hell is it going to be? And so in some senses, I have an easier time writing for other people than for myself.
That's interesting because I had a client or a client. You're speaking clients and I got my brain thinking about it. He's a producer and he does a lot of stuff for sync licensing. And his name is Justin Gray. He was on the podcast about a month or two ago. And he talked about composing for other projects. He says he finds it easier because he's got like a confine of limitations that he can work in. Do you find that that's easier to do when you have a set of instructions to write to?
Yeah, I really do. And you know, like, producers and songwriters are creative beasts, and they have different kinds of brains that they switch into. And I'm always fascinated about knowing what kind of creator the person sitting next to me is if I'm collaborating. And some people die if they're not self-expressing, and other people need rules to feel like they have an understanding of what to create. And that's the latter is what you described and how I'd characterize myself. And similar to those two camps, I group music makers into like composer brains and like beat making brains. And you know, pop music is vertical, like it's very loop based. You have sections of songs that can sometimes directly copy paste, and it's built in a way that you're just vertically figuring out all the pieces before you move on. Composition has very little rhythmic fabric. Like, generally classical music doesn't have grooves, and it just develops. It's just a story. Like, you wouldn't read a book and go to another page and the page is repeated from the previous page or the previous chapter. That's what like pop music and beat making are. And I find that they're very two different. Like, I have to summon both of those kinds of brains for when I'm film scoring or when I'm making a pop song. And it was so hard. I did a lot this year. It was really tricky to like actually understand what things to quiet down and what things to turn on when I needed to get a certain kind of thing done. And I found that most of my film scoring was really boring at first, and it was very loopy. And I found that my pop writing was kind of uninspired, and it was just kind of like not that interesting or surprising, should I say. And one of my favorite things is like finding composers that can make really banging beats. Like, somebody that's fluent in both worlds is, I think, one of the most rare and valuable breeds of people. And I'm on a quest to find those people and work with them because I love that kind of like dual understanding of how to make something super catchy and super giant and big, but also interesting and have good chord writing and like have some like sophistication into it that's like more composer based.
Sure. So let's get into that a little bit. How do you bring out that quote unquote epicness in a song, specifically like if you're composing a track? Like, how do you do that? Like, how do you, there's so many things, especially somebody who, like myself, who I played piano for the last 15 years of my life. So I have music knowledge, but I have never played in an orchestra, nor do I really know the ins and outs of an orchestra. So when somebody like myself wants to sit down and compose a track, how do you look at all the different instruments and, you know, tweak them properly so they sound authentic and not, you know, fake?
Yeah, it depends a little bit on like the style that you're making and what you're going for. My first answer is like texture is what creates epicness. I mean, epic is kind of an overused trope at this point, but it mm-hmm. refers to like a sense of scope. Like epic is huge generally. Mm-hmm. And when you have texture and layers, it creates a sense of depth. So mm-hmm. like when things sound far away, like a giant French horn section belting, things feel giant because you're imagining this huge, almost like orchestra type ensemble with electronics. It took me a long, I mean, I gravitated towards the big, epic, beautiful progressive house because I felt comfortable with layers and textures. And it takes a lot of just like, you know, because if you put too much paint on the page, it's just going to be a mess. So you really got to learn how to carve things around. And what you start to find is like, you'll know that a certain frequency creates the illusion of being giant. But if you solo it, it actually isn't eating up a ton of space. And so like for those old style, like I had a track that was like my first release called Beam, which is just like big giant chord stabs. I had figured out like, oh, I just need like a super distorted, short piano that just doubles the melody because it'll give some attack to it. And it's the same thing with like airy, buzzy sounds. They create a high frequency that's really exciting, but you can't allow the entire instrument to play full bore because then it's going to start to eat up and merge and just glob over everything else. And so you start to learn like, oh, there's rolls to this stuff and the whole will sound big, but the parts might be deceptively like thin sounding.
That's a good point. I've learned, you know, in my production quests that I tend to like have so many ideas and I throw them all out and I try to make them work, but it comes down to it's too much.
Yeah.
And you listen to a lot of pop music, there's really like barely even 10 things going on. Like throughout the whole track, like you said, it's copy and pasted and every genre is different. But the complex thing too with like orchestral music is it seems like there's a lot, but there's really not. So like a beginner in composing gets that confused with, oh, I got to throw this and that and layer this. And they have 100 different things going on and it just convolutes everything. And I think that's probably the biggest misconception.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you bring up because I would describe if I wanted a dense orchestra sound, I might do it differently than if I wanted a dense electronic production. Like, when you're using electronics, you're inventing sounds. You're inventing new instruments every time you pull up a synth and start EQing it like it's sure. never been heard like that before. So you can really, and there's an infinite size to the amount of things you can layer as long as you're carving them. When you want things to be big with orchestra writing, you similarly add a lot of instruments, but you also need the writing to be very complementary. So you have to have like an understanding of like counterpoint and like how to fill in spaces, because if you just copy and paste one piano roll to 10 instruments, it's not going to sound 10 times bigger generally. You can get away with it like 2 or 3 times and create a bigger sound, but then you need a complementary part that starts to just, and I'm learning this a lot because I'm doing some trailer-esque type of stuff right now, which is I would describe like the pop version of orchestra writing, where it's like you need it to be hyper compressed, hyper loud, no dynamics, just blasting away. And I'm discovering that when I treat the orchestra the way I would treat an EDM record, it doesn't respond the same way. And that's one of the tricky things. And, you know, my style is specific. Like, you make such a great point that this era of pop music that we're in right now, it's not stylistic to be big. It's stylistic to be minimal. I mean, what we've all learned is how captivating great songwriting can be. Like, if you literally just give me a world-class written a cappella and a bass line, that could be a hit song. And that weight that a vocal carries, I don't think you can get away with as just an instrumental. Like, there's just something about the voice that it just captures your attention. Mm-hmm. And if it's written well and the math is good and the arrangement's great and it has a good structure and phrasing to it, like, you really need to get out of the way of the vocal rather than add things onto it. So I think in this whole conversation, I'd also probably distinguish like anything with a vocal versus anything that's just an instrumental.
Sure.
But yeah, my style of writing is like throw too much paint on the wall and carve back till it's not overwhelming. And that's not everybody else's mode of creation, but I like dense music and that's the best way I've been able to figure out how to get it.
Yeah, when I think of like the simple music, I'm thinking of like Dua Lipa's tracks come to mind. Like, there's really not a lot going on, but the vocal is what carries the whole track. And she's got, you know, the interesting lyrics and people can relate to some of these, you know, relationships and whatever she's singing. I don't listen to her a lot, but the production is really not that complex.
It gets into another category though, and you're totally right, but it's that great sound design can capture your attention in a way that weaker sound design needs more elements to stay interesting. Mm. Like if your kick and your snare and your bass part, they punch so well and they sound so interesting, you really don't need more. But you'll find, and this is where everybody gets screwed, is that they go, I have a kick and a bass and a snare, but this track feels boring. And it's because the sound design's not good enough. And that's something that's unique to pop that we don't really deal with the same way in orchestra world. I mean, you want to have a good mix down, basically, but you can't reshape a cello to sound better than all the rest of the cellos everybody's been hearing for centuries. Like, you know, so that's like my whole spiel about, like, you know, sound design is a really important thing to be good at as well, because it makes life easier in other ways.
Mm. Going back just a little bit, what does it take to bring out emotion in a track? Like you talked about having track being really emotional. How do you do that in a track? Like what are some of the techniques that you specifically use in orchestral music that really brings out emotion?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it just all comes down to chords. Like, you know, I never listened to anything but classical, like I said, so I didn't really get used to hearing the voice that often. Like, I was just listening to film scores and orchestra music, and like, you can tell a story with a chord progression in a way that's, you know, abstract, and it's something so relatable, but it's not a sentence in English that you'd understand, but you could just feel like, I can tug you along in a chord progression and make you feel slightly nostalgic there, but then you've got a bit of warmth and you've got comfort here, and then all of a sudden it's just the most grand, epic, uplifting thing ever. And like, just by choosing the right chords, I can tug you along that way. And that's probably like home base for me. Every creator has like a thing they're so strong at that they don't even need to think much about because it just comes naturally to them. And chord writing for me is like my jam. Like, I know that I can get a chord progression to turn out the way I want it to. Everything else is chaos, and I like can fight tooth and nail and like, you know, kill myself trying to figure out other things. But I know the story that I want to tell, and it's literally just the chord writing. I mean, in addition to that, you've got what instruments are playing the chords that you're writing, and that's another big factor. And I gravitate towards organic sounds. I just got a new little upright piano, and I love the way that sounds. You hear a lot of, you know, naked like guitar playing in my music. I find that to be very emotional as well. You know, emotion is far more than chords, obviously, but I find that like that's where I can really paint what I need to paint emotionally, is just by picking the right chords.
So how do you train your ear in something like that? Like, you obviously went to school for it, but how can somebody who maybe can't afford to go to school or maybe doesn't want to go to school, how can they train their ears to find these things and then scale themselves back in a production? Like, oh, this is too much and I recognize that. I need to pull back.
Yeah, I mean, not to be weird about it, but like understanding the emotional reaction that your chords have, I think that's something you either sort of have or you don't. Like, you can tell when people like are unrefined, but they have a really great, like, as producers, we get sent demos from people all the time. And I can tell when somebody sounds like, you know, they're in the beginning of their quest of learning how to produce, but they actually have a really beautiful musical spirit, because the ideas like are it's like pretty immediate. Like, I feel something when I hear this. It sounds like crap, but I'm feeling something. Mm-hmm. But I will say that music theory is just it's such a great tool belt is what it is. And like, I think I haven't dove into this because I studied it in college, but I think there's amazing like YouTube courses and all kinds of series that can teach you about theory. And your music won't get better because you know theory, but it will give you options. Every single time you get somewhere, you can think, oh, I could modulate, I learned about that, or okay, I could, you know, borrow a major chord here in a minor key or whatever, like I learned about that. And so you'll start to like have this Rolodex of options that you can pull if you get stuck, or if you know, like, I heard this song and I love it, and I know that the chord writing is one of the reasons that I love it, so now you can sort of integrate that into your like syntax and then make that a part of what you do. So like getting a formal education, as we all know, it's not necessary to have a great career in music. You know, so many famous people can't read a note of music. We know that that's okay. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that all those people, as great as they are, they'd be even better if they learned, you know, some things about theory, because they'd have more options at their disposal to choose from. Their brains are and their hearts are so beautiful and amazing. And that was one of the cool parts about working with Avicii, is that he was one of those guys that like didn't speak a lick of music, but I would just sit there at the piano and he'd be like, play this for me, and then play some shit. And he'd go, okay, transpose that up to the black notes. So I'd just transpose it to like F sharp. And then he would just play and come up with these little pentatonic melodies, because, you know, there's only five notes in the pentatonic scale and there's five black keys in a scale. And so all of his melodies are like these really catchy, upbeat pentatonic melodies. And it's like, oh shit, that's so cool. Like his process has like almost like centered him on a sound that's his, that I just thought that was really interesting, where it was almost an example of like not knowing something was pretty interesting.
That is, I find that some of the best melodies come from the people who don't know what they're doing, because music tends to lay down so many rules. There's so many of this, you can't do this because then this counterpoint isn't right. And then this, you know, this is not in the key and you got to do this. But with people who don't know all those rules, they just play what sounds good. And that sounds what Avicii does. And he's got some of the most iconic electronic music melodies that probably will ever be written.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue a little bit with that language. Like, I consider those folks the best at knowing what they're doing. They just didn't exactly get the vocabulary to communicate it, what they're doing. But those people, like, I don't know. I listen to their melody writing and I go, that shit is advanced. And just because they didn't happen to take a music class in high school, I don't think if they had taken those music classes, they wouldn't be able to write those great melodies. I think that's just something you're born with. Like, great melodies. I don't know why. I just feel like that's something you can't really teach. Like, you just write great melodies. And it's an interesting space we're talking about, because it is true that like sometimes people make unconventional decisions that are really nice. Like Post Malone does stuff every once in a while that I'm like, I don't think, but yeah, then again, he does play an instrument, so I think he just knows. But sometimes there's like people do things that I almost describe it as like piano roll writing, where like a lot of people will just keep pushing notes around the piano roll until they like it. And you end up coming up with some things that are, or you stumble into a melody in a different route that you take than if you played it at the piano. And that's something I think about a lot too, is that like sometimes if I have too much intent with a piece of music, I don't get like a quality of randomness or excitement that I'm looking for. And so like sometimes I just have to like not pretend like I'm writing anything and just make chaos. And then out of the chaos, I'll pluck something that seems interesting and then start my like intent musical piece.
Sure. So what was your biggest takeaway from working with Avicii?
I mean, I think the biggest takeaway was like what I described, where he was just like, he has his own musical spirit. Oh, you know what it was that was so inspiring? I totally forgot about this. There was a specific moment in time where everybody was doing the exact same thing in EDM, and they were either, you know, an acolyte of his or a couple other DJs. And in that moment in Interscope, in one of the studios, I was with him as he was like, I want to make this folk country influenced electronic music. And now it's so obvious because we know those hits and they're so great, but like it felt like weird and thrilling and terrifying and exciting, and I didn't have any stake in it. Like, this was this dude's career, not mine. And he was like, every singer was like from that folk tradition, from a country tradition. Like, you know, we got this top line from the guy that wrote like Little Less Conversation for Elvis, and he wrote Addicted to You, and it's just this recording of this old man who's like lived a life and just like singing this broken song. And it was like, fuck, this is cool. And then Tim puts like the kick underneath it and his little Avicii chords. And then I got to stand there and watch as he took it to Ultra and had the whole world hate him for a couple weeks when it first came out, and think that it was just garbage, and then watch those songs become hits, and then for that whole thing to just grow. So like, I really learned like how courageous you kind of need to be to like invent something special and something new, like, and you're gonna get shit for it too. Like, it's not something where you're just celebrated overnight. And I think that experience, whatever, 6 years ago now, is something that has stayed with me and sort of carried with me into this record, which is like my version of just kind of like saying fuck it to all the stuff I've done and just making something that I find inspiring.
Sure. Yeah, that Avicii is and always will be one of the greats.
Yeah.
Moving on just a little bit. You do music full time as a living, correct? So tell us about how you can get started doing that, and how can somebody transition? Like, you work a 9 to 5, say you're a barista or you work in retail or whatever, you want to quit your job. What are some things you can do to actively start, you know, kind of working on this career in music?
Yeah, that's the $1 million question, really.
It is.
You know, everybody in music gets asked that by a lot of kids a lot of times. And it's sometimes a little tricky because you don't want to, like, you know, a lot of people, they want the result. They are not willing to just like dive into the career of it. And I kind of describe the phases of these sorts of careers in a couple chunks. And the first one takes like, you know, 3 years minimum, which is like pure survival mode. Like, if you quit your day job, the first thing you need to be able to do is pay the rent. So you need to do whatever it takes to get that money. And that could mean a whole lot of things. I mean, it could mean like being an assistant for an engineer. It could mean writing music for a yoga app that's ambient. It could mean, you know, doing ghost production for people. Maybe you put out your own records and you get lucky, or you write a TikTok smash, or like, you know, there's a whole lot of different ways. And that's where like the most successful people are the ones that are versatile and thoughtful and creative in their approach. Like, as humans, we like to feel comfortable about like, join a job and here's your safety net and here's the way up. Like, it's like the military. You work hard enough, they'll promote you a rank. Like, a career in music is not that at all. It is just the wilderness, and you need to like pick up a rock and figure out how to find dinner for yourself. And I think one of the great aspects of that is that if you survive, you come out with like street knowledge, or whatever you'd call it, like street smarts, but then also like a bevy of trade skills that you weren't planning on having. And for me, it was, I want to be a film composer. So then all of a sudden I learned how to work in Logic. I learned how to make electronic music. I learned how to write songs, which was massive for me. I learned how to sing songs, which then became massive for my project with Mako. And then learn how to compose and all kinds of different things that are like, you know, auxiliary to those core things. And so my value to the job market just like spiked, because now I could be useful to a whole lot of different folks doing very specific things. And not all those things are like, oh, it's my dream to be this, but it's just, that's what's getting me in the door. Like, I wanted to be a DJ at first, but my productions were so shit. Like, nobody was going to bring me on for that. But I learned how to write vocals for DJs. And, like, I didn't want to be a songwriter at the time, but I was like, that got me in the door with Avicii. And my productions sure as hell weren't going to do that for me. So it was just, like, a nice way to keep backdooring all over the place. And then, like, 5 years later, I'm like, shit, I'm kind of like known for writing songs for people now. Like, it's one of my strengths, and I never would have expected it. And, you know, then when you're building your own project, you can actually use all those skills that you've built to, you know, make your thing so that you're more self-sustainable and you don't rely on a producer or a songwriter or a singer to come in and help you make your art. You can just wake up one morning and make it. So that was my road, and I highly recommend it to people. But it takes almost like a business, an entrepreneurial spirit, I'd say, rather than just like, let me focus and hone down on one thing and then I'll make it one day. Like, you kind of just got to figure it out.
So you got to do a whole bunch of other things and be a master of all trades or a jack of all trades and a master at none kind of start. And then do you hone in on the things you're really good at?
Yeah, so that's like the next phase I'd describe, which is like, now you've secured a living for yourself. So what do you want? And that was like the last couple of years for me. It was like, okay, now I have options to make a living. So what do I want my career to look like? And what kind of creator do I want to be known for? So like you sort of described, I started to hone in on the things that I like best. And I found that I sincerely like a nice mix of writing for Mako, like, which means producing, singing, songwriting. And then film scoring. I love working with orchestra. And then writing songs for spec, like for commercial, like for League of Legends, pop songs for other people. So it's kind of this trifecta that I've got. And it's, even that is too much to juggle, seriously. And I think, you know, one of the downsides is that you end up peaking later in your life if you're a jack of all trades, master of none, like it, and you want to just master all of those things. You're not going to be able to until you've been doing this for over a decade, just because you're biting off so much to chew. But some people, you know, everybody's road's so different. And like some people are like these brilliant flashes in a moment in time where they did a thing or they made a track a certain way and it just hit the zeitgeist. And then that's like that opened the portal for them to just dive through and then become internationally successful. But for somebody like me, I've always been interested in just a quiet, long, stable, amazing career in music rather than like somebody that's just famous and then trying to like figure out a way to maintain that level of success. I don't think I would do very well in that environment.
Sure. So how do you juggle kind of the three different kind of trifecta things that you do now? Like, do you delegate X amount of hours per day to each project, or do you work on something until it's finished and then move on? Like, how do you juggle those three things, and which one is your favorite if you have one?
You know, I hope it's not a cop-out, but I truly found that I like the three. I like dancing between them. And every time I'm spending too much time in one and I move to another, I go, God, I so love that I'm scoring this TV show right now. Like, it's so refreshing. But yeah, the bane of my existence is figuring out how to balance those three things without killing myself. And unfortunately, you know, I'm 31 now and I've like spent almost the last like six straight years just working and doing nothing else. So I have a tough time with, you know, balancing things and saying no to things. I try and tack things off, you know, in highest level of emergency. So like if, you know, we're prepping some orchestra cues to be recorded in Berlin next month. So like working on that stuff is highest priority because it's got a clock on it. The only tricky thing is like releasing a Mako record is not something that has a schedule to it. So I kind of have to invent my own urgency so that I get that done because other projects have, you know, much stricter deadlines. So, you know, I do my best with my management to just kind of like plot out my calendar. And now that we've gotten a sense for how slow I can be on making things, we try and be smart about like saying yes to only the amount of things we know we can chew and like budgeting a realistic amount of time to get those things done.
Great. I think that's it's interesting that you found that trifecta. I think a lot of people have difficulties doing all that. So on going a little bit further is, how do you manage those things? Like, are there any tools that you use? Do you have any tips for people juggling big projects that they love that they're just like, I cannot live if I did not do this specific project? Like for you, writing for Mako, songwriting or writing, you know, scoring films.
Oh, I mean, if you stumble into things you love that much, like, I'm psyched for you. Like, it's a blessing to be overwhelmed by work that you love. Like, yes. I literally don't have enough hours in the day to do things that I love doing. And so, you know, a lot of it's like anxiety management. And like, as an employer, in some sense, like, I need to have a reputation for being delivering things on time, you know, having a good attitude, being an open-minded collaborator, taking criticism well. And then in Makoland, I have to learn how to have an opinion and a creative vision and stick to it and delegate to the people around me that are making videos and helping me with things to like help me realize that vision. So it's like a exchange between being the boss and being the employee between things. And you know, like, everybody's got their own methods. Like, I'm pretty good when I'm putting things on my calendar, but I'm real shit if I'm like trying to invent a routine. Like, I have a sense for like, if somebody needs a song, I have a pretty honest sense for, okay, I need five full studio days to like find the heart of this song, record it, and get you a demo. So I don't promise things that like infringe on that like internal clock that I've got going. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's a good problem to have. If anybody out there is stuck with too many things that they love to do, like, that's a blessing for sure.
Yeah, that's definitely a good thing to a good problem to have. So yeah, that's kind of all the questions that I have. This was such a great conversation. Thanks for jumping on with me and answering all these questions. It's always a delight to be able to dig into somebody's career and really figure out what makes them.
Yeah, tick. Man, this is the fun stuff too. Like, these interviews are always great because this is like what life is. It's just like figuring out how to make all this music and make a career out of it. So I love talking about this stuff. Obviously, I'm so fucking chatty.
Lastly, I want to wrap it up. Before I let you go, how can listeners keep up with you and reach out if they have any questions or just keep up with the projects you're working on?
Yeah, so like, you know, I'm on all your normal social media apps, but I will say, like, we developed, excuse me, a Discord this past year that I just love, and I'm super active on it. So join our community there. There's a link to it, like, in my Instagram description. I have this link tree that has a whole bunch of, you know, links to stuff, and the Discord is on there. Feel free to join us. It's, like, a super great community, and for whatever reason, like, it really works well because I'll just have it on another monitor when I'm producing all day. So I'm just chatting with everybody and hanging out, so that's a great place to get in touch. But then, yeah, you know, find my music on Spotify and everywhere else that you listen.
Cool. And I'll link all that stuff in the show notes below as well for everybody to check out. Man. Yeah, cool. Well, thanks again for being on the show. This was great. I hope you stay safe out there. Happy holidays. And, you know, if you're traveling or doing anything, safe travels.
You too, Lennon. Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good night, Alex.